Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Richard Pivnica and triply honored to be here as a member of the club's Board of Governors, your chair today, and as the Honorary Consul General of the Czech Republic. That means I should probably hire a staff to collect all the checks I'm getting. Don't worry, that will be cut from the radio tape. If your phone rings, that means you're volunteering to contribute to the club. So we welcome our audiences here and on radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Well, now I would like to introduce our panelists as well as the photographer for our exceptional exhibit at the club. Robert Caron, Peter Polacek, John Connolly, and Al Sanad, and our photographer for the exhibit, Paul Goldsmith. Paul. Peter, would you like to take it away?
Sure. Well, we'll start with John, and I will follow up with about 10 minutes, and then we have two more five-minute presentation. That's about 35 minutes, and then we'll be left with 25 minutes for questions and answers.
Thank you. Good evening. So my job is to give some historical background. I teach history at UC Berkeley, and I teach the history of East Central Europe. So what I want to ask is, what do we make of all these pictures that we've been looking at, these fascinating black and white photos from the late 1960s, from 1968? What do they mean in historical context? What can they tell us about the past? What kind of questions do they raise for historians? You might say, if you remember the Cold War, that this is just another instance of something we know very well, which is the presence, the regular presence of Soviet tanks on the streets of East European cities, crushing the desires of local populations for freedom, right? 1953, East Berlin. 1956, Budapest, Hungary. 1981, Poland. In that case, it was in fact Polish tanks, but there was an expectation that Soviet tanks would invade Poland and crush Solidarity at any moment. So 1968 in Czechoslovakia seems just one more case of a string of incidents where East European peoples tried to throw off Soviet tyranny and were frustrated by armed force. But I want to suggest to you that in Czechoslovakia, as I always tell my students, things are always a bit different than they appear to be, and they're always different from the rest of Eastern Europe. All right? Two of the things that are important to keep in mind are that Czechoslovakia was the one industrialized region of Eastern Europe in the Habsburg Empire, and it's the one place that supported democracy all the way up until the Nazi invasion of 1938. So it's a place with very strong history of industrialization, urbanization, but also of democracy. But in the case of 1968, what you see is paradoxical in another sense, because contrary to what you might believe, Soviet-style socialism or Stalinism, communism, was not in fact imposed upon Czechoslovakia after the war, but more than anywhere else in Eastern Europe, with the possible exception of Yugoslavia, it was the place where the population, the broad masses of Czechs and Slovaks, actually voted for communist rulers. In 1945, Czechoslovakia, the territory, was liberated by Soviet and American troops. One thing you may not know is that in September of 1945, both armies left Czechoslovak territory. That is, the Red Army was no longer in Czechoslovakia after World War II. So if we're asking why communism was imposed in Czechoslovakia, it's not because of the direct presence of the Red Army. 1946, relatively free elections, got the communists 42% of the votes in the Czech lands. So 42% of the Czech citizens were willing to vote freely for the communists in 1946. That is, by the way, more than the Nazis got in Germany in 1932. Only 37.8%. So you might say the Czechs, oddly, this population with democratic heritage, voted for a totalitarian party. And then in 1948, there was a seizure of power in February by the communists. This was not something that was imposed upon Czechoslovakia by the Soviet Union. There were no Soviet troops. It was carried out by the Czechoslovak Communist Party with strong assistance from Czechoslovak Social Democrats. There was one significant group that protested this seizure of power, and those were Czech students in Prague in February of 1948. Otherwise, this was a relatively peaceful event. Czech Stalinism was more or less, or I should say Czechoslovak Stalinism was something that was produced by Czechoslovak society. The purges of the early 1950s were some of the worst seen in Eastern Europe. They were produced out of this organization that was itself a product of the Czechoslovak workers' movement. Stalinism was so solid in Czechoslovakia, believe it or not, that in 1961, long after Poland and Hungary had tried to throw off Stalinism, it was the Soviets themselves who had to try to convince the Czech and Slovak communist leaders to do away with Stalinism, to de-Stalinize. And only after 61 does a process get underway, which is quite interesting, leading to 1968, of liberalization. One of the early benchmarks of this gradual process in the cultural realm was a Kafka conference, a conference devoted to Franz Kafka in 1963. After this point, 1963, the early 1960s, you might say that Czechoslovakia began discovering another part of itself, of its own identity. Suddenly life came into the arts, into film. You all know Miloš Forman, right? He made some of his most important movies, early movies in these years. You know in literature, Kundera, Škvoretzky. In scholarship, certain areas of scholarship that had been suppressed under Stalinism found new life, like sociology, for example, history, legal studies. The culmination of this process was December of 1967, when reform communists and intellectuals in Czechoslovakia came together with a group of Slovak communists to oust Stalinist leadership under a man whose name you won't have heard, Antonín Novotný. And his replacement was a little-known Slovak communist named Alexander Dubček. He was a man that the Soviets believed they could trust. He spoke perfect Russian. He had learned Russian in Moscow. He himself was of worker background. He was a Slovak. He was somebody that Brezhnev believed would be perfectly dependable. In fact, as we know, Dubček was a man who was interested in toleration, interested in a different kind of socialism, socialism with a human face. He spearheaded a reform movement in Czechoslovakia, the most important feature of which was to lift censorship in March of 1968. For the first time in an East European city, with the possible exception of Budapest in 1956, there was a free press for several months. East Europeans, actually many East Germans, Hungarians, Poles, flocked to Prague to breathe this atmosphere of freedom. Other people were watching as well, as we know. The hardline communists in East Germany and Poland and Hungary, and of course the Soviet Union were watching. They were very afraid of what freedom might mean for their own rule. There were constant threats to the Czechoslovak leaders, the reform communists, in the spring and the summer months of 1968. To their great credit, Dubček and his comrades refused to buckle under. They refused to crush this press freedom that they themselves had launched, that itself was getting out of their control as communists. And the result was, after many warnings, what you see on these photographs, tanks suddenly rolling into Prague in the evening hours of August 20 and the early morning hours of August 21st, 1968. Taking the leaders, you see this in some of Paul's pictures in the old Central Committee building, literally kidnapping the Communist Party leadership, including Dubček, taking them away to an unknown location. It was thought they might be liquidated. There were plans actually to liquidate physically this leadership. There was another group within the party that volunteered to become collaborators of the Soviet Union. It was discovered, however, and this is in some ways the direct historical evidence we have from Paul's photograph, that these collaborators were unable to summon any kind of popular support. You see what the populists wanted in these photographs. They wanted an end to the Soviet occupation. They wanted a continuation of the democratic reforms of Dubček. And so great was the humiliation of this very small group of collaborators that they, in fact, had themselves to take refuge in a tank where they were spirited away to the Soviet embassy. The population overwhelmingly showed its support for the Prague Spring, for reform. I'm going to just say a couple of words of conclusion because we don't have much time tonight, but I said that Czechoslovakia doesn't really make much sense to historians, and one thing that doesn't make sense after the fact that I've just told you about, that Czechoslovaks freely accepted communism, is that in 1968 they obviously had enough of communism. You see overwhelming evidence in the photos that you've seen of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Czechs and Slovaks, mostly young but not only young, rejecting that model. So what had happened? Where did these young people learn their democracy from? They had only known a communist socialist society. What was happening there? You might guess that they came from households where one man was revered above all others, a man whose name couldn't be spoken under Czech Stalinism, that is Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, okay, the founding president of Czechoslovakia, and a man well associated, rightly associated with democratic values. What you see on the streets of Czechoslovakia, in one sense, is a reconnecting to this old democratic tradition. But there's another and less fortunate kind of question, which is, why did this euphoria that Paul, who spent not fully 2 days, I believe, in Prague, hurried these photos off to the West where some of them were printed, why did this euphoria, this support for reform, not last? As we saw, the tanks themselves were unable to crush the desire of people for freedom. You see that this man dares to raise his fist against the tank. You'll see in other photos, you'll see people engaging the Soviet soldiers in conversation. Why did this euphoria for change not last? Well, the most direct answer is that the Czechoslovak leadership, when it was spirited away to Moscow, signed the so-called Moscow Protocols 5 days after the invasion, agreeing to do away with this freedom of speech, to reimpose full party control. Dubček himself agreed to become, in some senses, a neo-Stalinist. And after that point, in about 15 months' time, the old situation was quickly returned. The word in Czech is normalizacja, normalization. Things were brought back to the old normal Stalinist mode. And in the 1970s, Czechoslovakia became one of the quietest, least interesting, most oppressive dictatorships in Eastern Europe. And there were Soviet troops on the ground, but this kind of return to socialist rule, to strict Stalinist rule, neo-Stalinist rule, in fact, was not something the Soviets demanded or imposed. It was a product of the Czechoslovak ruling apparatus, involving the removal of hundreds of thousands of people who supported the Prague Spring, but it was done by Czechs and Slovaks themselves. How do we explain this? How do we account for this tremendously oppressive experience where, I'll just give you one brief anecdote. When I visited Prague in 1984, at the height of the Cold War, a woman wouldn't even admit to me that her daughter had been baptized. The anti-religious campaign was so strong in Czechoslovakia that people didn't dare show their faces in church. And the same was true for anybody who supported any kind of reform movement. I met a man who was a high-class intellectual in 1991 who told me that he was thrown out of his school where he was teaching in 1977 and demoted to bricklayer, to manual labor, not for having supported the dissidents in 1977, but having refused to sign a petition against the dissidents. He was thrown out of his school. This man is named Jan Urban, a very important intellectual. So Czechoslovakia became a very ugly place. Why was that the case? I have a theory, and I'll close with this, and I think it comes down to education. I said that in 1948, the one group in Czechoslovak society to resist this imposition of communist rule from within Czechoslovak society were Czech students in Prague. These were liberal in the European sense of the word and conservative students. At the same time, other students, social democrat and communist students, were supporting the seizure of power. What I think happened in 1968 is that these two wings of the Czechoslovak intelligentsia came together. That is, former communists, people like Jiří Pelikán, Čestmír Císař, very prominent reform communists, came together, in a sense, with this other segment of the intelligentsia, and they were the ones who pushed forward for reform. If you look at the pictures in Paul's photographs, you will see overwhelmingly young people. I'm guessing they were students from intelligentsia families. And what you see after this point, I would theorize, is a backlash of those not belonging to the intelligentsia, of those who resented the intelligentsia for its knowledge and privileges. And those are the people who basically controlled Czechoslovakia until 1989. This is only a speculation, but I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. I think it was a very good introduction and also summary of the past 50 years. Good evening. I never used this before in my life, until you showed it to me how to use it. I'm honored to share my memories of one of the most moving events of my life, the Russian occupation of my former homeland. First, I would like to spend a few minutes on my family background. Hitler troops marched into Czechoslovakia on March 15, 1939. 6 months later, my father escaped through Yugoslavia, rented a small fishing dinghy to travel to the Italian coast, and later used a fishing boat again to make the French coast. He signed up with the Czechoslovak units fighting in France. It was a short time before France fell to Nazi Germany, and about 8,000 Czechoslovaks moved to the United Kingdom. Winston Churchill visited Czechoslovak troops in the 10th city outside of Chester. From there, soldiers were assigned to RAF and other British military units. Over the next 18 months, my father was very actively involved in uniting World Student Movement against Nazism in London. At the World Youth Conference in London, attended by Eleanor Roosevelt, my father was elected president of the World Youth Council in 1942. Mrs. Roosevelt took sponsorship of his trip to the United States. When my father made 56 presentations in 39 states over a 4 month period of 1943, culminating with a White House visit with Henry Wallace, then Vice President of the United States. No surprise, Gestapo learned about my dad's activities, and in early 1943, Nazi leather coats came to our apartment in Prague and took my mom away to a concentration camp. I was left alone in the apartment when I was barely 3 years old. Neighbors took care of me and were hiding me in a farmhouse for the remaining years of the war. In March 1945, my father was asked by the Czechoslovak Secretary of State, Jan Masaryk, to come to San Francisco to assist in drafting the Charter of the United Nations, and he resided for a few months not very far from here at the War Memorial Opera House, where the United Nations Charter was later signed by 27 nations in May of 1945. In mid-May 45, my father came from London, my mother from the concentration camp, and I returned to Prague from a farmhouse. A few weeks later only, my dad was appointed chief of the Czechoslovak military mission to Berlin, where repatriations of 2.5 million Sudeten Germans, post-war economic development of Europe, and forming of Marshall Plan were the major working issues between 45 and 48. In these efforts, my father had frequent cooperation with General William Draper, in charge of Czechoslovakia in 45, and General Lucius Clay. 2 years later, during the Communist coup of February 48, my father was among the first hundreds of arrested, interrogated by Russian agents during his 14 months of solitary confinement, charged with treason, and sentenced to 13 years of hard labor in prison. After my eighth grade, I was sent to girls-only school as my punishment. Now, I would like to fast forward to 1967, 1 year before the Soviet occupation of Prague. There was an annual session of the Central Committee of the Czechoslovak Communist Party in Prague in October 67. For the first time ever in communist history, President Novotny was criticized by Alexander Dubček, and within 3 months, Novotny was replaced by Dubček in January 68. From that time, January 68, we mark an 18-month period ending in September 69, referred to as Prague Spring. The goal was reforming the failed system into socialism with human face. Dubček in 68 took over a Stalinist bureaucratic regime already on the verge of bankruptcy and bursting at the seams. The system had to be reformed to avoid disintegration. For 20 years, it had been forbidden to analyze, evaluate, discuss, or criticize. Dubček lifted the censorship in 68, as John mentioned before, and gave the green light to criticism, and this gave the backbone of the Prague Spring. It was at this time when the prison sentence of my father, as well as of tens of thousands of my father's colleagues, were nullified and all political prisoners were released. However, the storm of public opinion was too swift, and once the floodgates had been opened, it was impossible to swim against the tide. I took part in the Czechoslovak national holiday of May 1, 1968. Maybe Robert and Al also remember it, at the Wenceslas Square, Prague's historic avenue, a never-ending procession of hundreds of thousands of people full of enthusiasm and hope. Organizations which had been silenced for 20 years, the international brigades from the Spanish Civil War, veterans from the Western fronts of the Second World War, political prisoners, YMCA, Boy Scouts, clergy, leaders of all these organizations spent typically 5 to 15 years in communist prison. 267 political prisoners were hung in early 1950s. Within the next 3 months, heading to Soviet occupation between May and August, Czechs and Slovaks talked and requested economic liberties, architected by Professor Šik, recognized as father of the Czechoslovak reform. They requested a withdrawal from Military Warsaw Pact, withdrawal from COMECON, which is similar to what we have in NAFTA, Council for Mutual Economic Cooperation, or even requested conversion of the Czech crown and joining NATO. In hindsight, we now know that Brezhnev ordered military action as early as in April 1968. On the day of Russian occupation, August 21, 1968, my wife and I were glued to our TV at about 2 o'clock in the morning, listening to Radio Free Europe and Voice of America. Shortly before the midnight, the control tower of Prague Airport was overpowered by Russians, and huge transport Antonovs were landing every 5 minutes. The same concept, by the way, was used by Russians 11 years later when they occupied Kabul during Christmas of 1979. In the next few days, after August 21, 5 communist countries invaded Czechoslovakia using 29 divisions, close to 500,000 troops, 7,500 tanks rolled into the country from all directions, and 1,000 planes were used in order to promote international proletarian solidarity. Public transport was at standstill for many days. I walked nearly 2 hours to my office that morning, clearing tens of Russians' roadblocks. All of us spoke pretty decent Russian those days, but the very first 2 weeks, the Russian soldiers were ordered not to answer anything and to stay quiet. At work, as the chairman of Trade Union Management Board, I called a special meeting. All 9 members of our board voted unanimously that it is a blatant foreign invasion of our country. Many board members, having been devoted and idealistic communists for their lives, were openly crying and tearing all days long. I will never forget, you know, these days. Dubček and 6 other presidium members, as John mentioned, were arrested and flown to Moscow to sign a protocol legalizing aggression. Logistics and material supplies to 500,000 Soviet troops were absolutely poor. Czechs changed street signs and road signs everywhere through Czechoslovakia the very first day. And in some cases, Russian tanks were reported rolling back and forth to Germany and Poland for days. In the night, I was watching from our windows hungry Russian troops shooting ducks on Moldau River. 2 weeks in aggression, the troops had to be rotated, and new Russians, mostly of Far East origin, started slowly talking to us. We learned they expected Americans, since they were told that the Third World War had started and Czechoslovakia was occupied by Americans. On November 7, the anniversary of the Russian Revolution, Soviet flags were burned across the country and Soviet tanks were once again put on high alert. The Dubček crisis of the Prague Spring is known as the ice hockey game affair. On March 28, 1969, roughly half a year after the occupation, the Czechoslovak ice hockey team scored a second victory over the Soviet team at the World Championship in Stockholm. Anti-Soviet demonstrations started in Prague and Bratislava. Offices of Russian Aeroflot were set on fire. Similar incidents happened in other Czechoslovak towns. Hundreds of thousands of citizens demanded immediate withdrawal of Soviet troops. Marshal Grečko flew in unannounced to give Dubček and President Svoboda the last warning. In the next few months, Dubček was replaced by President Husák, and the communist tyranny continued in Czechoslovakia for another 20 years. Shortly before I left for Stanford in August of 69, I asked the Trade Union Management Board for a vote. 8 members voted accordingly with the Moscow Protocol, claiming we deserved fraternal assistance by the Warsaw Pact armies, while my vote was the only one claiming Soviets committed a clear aggression. Who was Alexander Dubček? In the spring of 71, I was invited to join a 5-member working group at Stanford, analyzing leading personalities of Prague Spring. 2 members were representing the State Department and CIA, and we had access to numerous classified materials. Dubček was born in Slovakia. John mentioned some of his background already. His father, Dubček's father, after the death of Lenin, emigrated to the Soviet Union in 1925, when Alex was 4 years old. Dubček returned to Slovakia in 1938, speaking fluent Russian and having Russian empathy and insights. Dubček was a devoted communist since his age of 18, when he joined the Slovak Communist Party. In 1955, Dubček returned to Moscow to study for 3 years at the Advanced Party School attached to the Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party. Dubček professed blind communist discipline with unshakable faith in communism. He always wanted his country to remain faithful to the Soviet Union. Promising major reforms and establishing socialism with human faith, he was the leading hero of the Czech dream during the Prague Spring. Dubček promised hope and change to us in 68 and was compared by us to what John F. Kennedy had been of the new America and the American dream, or what Obama was to 53% Americans in November 2008. His 2 weaknesses included idealistic naivety and indecision. During his 3 meetings with Comrade Brezhnev, who had to install him, prior to occupation of August 68, he was clearly fooled into believing the aggression would never happen while its planning was in progress. His indecision was one contributing factor to why his concept for socialism with human face lasted only 18 months. Thank you very much.
We are running out of time. I will be very brief. We got an excellent presentation for the gentlemen. There's very like an add to it. I can correct some of that, but it's not very important. I was born before World War II and left in Prague and left in late 68. During this time, I was witnessing 6 armies under my windows. Germans in, that was number one, then the Russian Liberation Army, which was the army which was created by German from the Russian people captured during World War II. That was in and out, that's 3. Germans out, and the Russians once more, Russian Red Army. That's just to give you illustration what we went through, right? 1968, late after thing which happened and well described, both of the gentlemen, me and my wife and our daughters, one of them was 5 months old and one of them was 5 years old, and she's here with us. We left for United States. I'm not going to go into detail of my family. It's very similar what Peter Palchek said to us. But I just want to mention one thing. The Czech army, when the Russian came in, they stay in the barracks, They were very obedient to Communist Party. They didn't do absolutely nothing. Very similar to what happened in 1939 when German came. Czech army didn't fight. Okay, it's very. I think it's interesting observation. When came after 1968-69, when it came to this normalization, and people basically, a vast majority of people, didn't fight communist, orthodox, nothing. They sort of went along. One of the reasons, I think, is that during these, from 1948 to 1968, about 8 million people went through the as a members of the Communist Party, not at the same time, but in and out. 8 million out of the 15 million population. Therefore, in today's leadership, which we have this so-called elite, political elite, more than 50% are former communists. Therefore, it gives you some balance to understand the situation which is over there. I would be more than happy to answer any question you may have. I know a lot about it. I was involved in many political things there, and even after 1969 and after the change 89, and if you are interested, I will be happy to answer any of your questions. Thank you very much.
I will try to squeeze in my little remarks. In 1968, I was 20 years old student, enrolled in MBA program in business school. And as a matter of fact, I did not even witness the actual Russian occupation of Prague firsthand because I was visiting England at that time. And so I can talk only about that very hard, gut-wrenching decision people who traveled outside Czechoslovakia at that time had to make. And, some people decided to return back to Czechoslovakia and some people decided to stay somewhere else. And I'm assuming that many of these decisions were made, thank you, by people who may be sitting even here in this audience today. My father was prosecuted like many other people who did not agree with the communist regime, and he was prosecuted because he was member of the American army during the war. And so you can imagine that the Prague Spring was a major political event for our entire family. Now, during the spring, meaning the spring time of the year, my desire was to secure some kind of permission from the Czech government to travel to the West so that I could see that evil capitalist system with my own eyes, right? It was the first opportunity I had because of the Prague Spring. And because I studied English, of course, I wanted to visit England. So I was lucky enough to get both the permission from the Czech government and British visa for about 2 months stay in England. And I didn't have a lot of money, so I traveled hitchhiking, which took me about 3 weeks to get to London. And then I got some kind of job. I was washing dishes in a restaurant close to Birmingham. And I was there during the fatal day for me, fatal day of August 21st. And I remember that day very vividly, even today, and I will remember it for the rest of my life. I woke up around 6. I got in a small, kind of ugly-looking hotel-provided service car. I turned on the radio, and all I heard was reporting on the Russian occupation of Czechoslovakia during the night. And initially, I didn't listen that closely. It didn't make a lot of sense to me because I was still half sleeping and thinking about his hard job in the kitchen. But something unusual, something urgent in the radio reporter's voice made me to listen more closely. And I think they even talked about panicking West German people, the population living close to the Czech borders, who thought that the Russian tanks will proceed all the way to the west. The thought was that the Czech events, the Prague Spring, has provided the Russian Politburo and Russian government with a reason to move to the west. So finally, I was sitting in that car, and I got it. And I started to cry. And I was sitting motionlessly in that car, and I was just whispering, mumbling, well, this is the end. This is the end of everything. And at that very moment, I remember that a warning of my death suddenly came to my mind. And I recall that when I was leaving Prague and my dad saw me off before my departure to England, he said, Robert, if something ever happens here while you are out of the country, don't ever come back. Now, he never trusted the Russians because he had some dealings with them during the war. He knew Russian mindset quite well, and now when I am over 60, I can clearly see that the Russian mindset has not changed much since then. So as this warning popped in my head, I realized that I will have to make very difficult life decision. So I arrived in the kitchen, and everybody came to me, and they hugged me, and, you know, the owner of the hotel even asked me if I wanted to take a day off, which was very unusual. And I didn't, because I needed to be busy rather than sitting on a sofa and watching the bad news. Now, what I wanted to say was that the British government almost immediately offered the Czech students visiting England financial help, and I was offered scholarship at some university in Birmingham. And British citizens took care of us. They offered free lodging, and, you know, not only to students, but simply people stuck in England. It was a genuine outpour of solidarity in the West in that particular time. And, of course, emotionally, for me, the most difficult thing was to decide whether or not to go back. So in the following days, I tried to call my parents, but it was very difficult because the telephone connection was frequently cut on the Czech side and most likely bugged. So I managed to reach them only twice, and their advice was very consistent and pretty straightforward. Don't ever come back. There is nothing good here for your future. Now, the problem for me was that I never had any desire to leave my home country. Yes, I hated the communist system, but like most Czechs, I knew my ways around. I had plenty of friends. I was quite successful making money in that state-sponsored market economy, black economy, which constituted probably 60-70% of the GDP at that time. I had some part-time job, and, you know, I was happy to be at home. So, what now? So I stayed in England for another couple of months. I still worked in some restaurants and in London and kept watching the bad news coming from Prague. And it was a very sad, very difficult period of my life. But ultimately, I decided to return home. This time by train, because I made some money, so it wasn't hitchhiking anymore. And I remember my dad waited for me at a completely dark Prague train station because there was a blackout when our train arrived. And when he saw me, he spread his arms like that, pointed to the dark train station lamppost like that, and rather than welcoming me happily, hey, I'm glad to see you, he goes, see, this is our new Czechoslovakia. This is what you came for. Nevertheless, I was happy. I was back home because deep inside I felt that England of 1968 was not my cup of tea. And I really never regretted that I made this decision, coming back to that ugly place, as John called it, or he called Czechoslovakia, ugly place of that time. So that's a different angle at Russian occupation. And I'm talking about it because it was very difficult for many people probably sitting here. So thank you very much.
Now we would start our question and answer period, and I would like to pose the first question before the audience does. Maybe, Peter, you could give us your view and the panel's view on the difference between the Prague Spring and the Hungarian uprising.
Does it work? Can you hear me? Difference between Prague Spring and Hungarian uprising. Let me start during the war years. I spent a couple of days 5 years ago in Hyde Park, New York, in the presidential library of FDR. It's a beautiful place. If you can go there, it's a gorgeous place. And I went through a lot of, you know, communication of the White House during the years of 40 to 44. And what you see from that is absolutely devotion to beat Nazis, but again, very panicky phobia. What will happen to Europe once we win the war? What will happen after 45? Especially related to France or Italy or Germany or Greece, where it was obvious that communism is very strong. And I think the Truman administration did very well to assist the fact that communists just lost very badly in France and in Italy and in Greece. Then John already mentioned the first uprising in Eastern Europe. It was very peaceful communist putsch of 48. Even when all the students were against it and maybe army was against it, there were mistakes made. But the first uprisings came, John mentioned the one in Berlin, there was another one in Poznan, 1953, and then came Hungary. And that lasted about 2 weeks. It started again with student revolt. And in the first week of November, it was very brutal. The commanders of Russian tanks were supposed just to roll through the crowds. So the loss on lives in Hungary was close to what it was for us in 9/11, close to 3,000 people. While in Czech Republic in 1968, it was very... we lost 27 or 67 people during that first week. So this is, you know, one difference. But what is very similar, that from Hungarian uprising and from the Prague Spring of 68, Prague Spring produced 300,000 immigrants. 300,000 is close to 2% of the population. The Hungarians' emigration was 200,000. Again, country of 10 million, Hungary, 200,000, it's about 2% again. And that rule of 2%, I heard, for example, in China. In 1980s, I traveled to China. I was consultant over there. And professors very often told me, but look, you know, we lost the best brains 50 years ago. Mao Zedong came, and 20 million best guys, they live, you know, in Taiwan. So again, 20 million in Taiwan and 1 billion, that's again 2%. If you take Sweden, so you know, socialism in Sweden, 2% of their, you know, best guys live abroad also. So one similarity was emigration. I mentioned the cost of human lives. Maybe John can add something to it. Difference between. Oh, I want to mention two names to you, which you know, Andy Groves and George Soros. They are products of 1956 uprising in Budapest. I went in San Francisco to a dinner with Andy Grove a few years ago when they claimed Andy Grove is probably the most important person in the United States of the past 25 years because he was behind Intel, behind chip, what we would do without the chip. So again, Andy Grove, George Soros are good examples of the byproduct of terrible uprising in Budapest.
I could just say something briefly. The most evident difference is that the Hungarian uprising was extremely violent, whereas the Prague Spring remained peaceful. The other difference is that in Hungary there was, you might call it an elemental explosion of unrest, of dissatisfaction, stemming from the fact that the party itself had been unwilling to reform, even in the slightest... It's probably a very important call, but thank you. The Czechoslovak communists, interestingly enough, they had thought that they learned the lessons of Budapest. Two things that they didn't attempt to do that Nagy had done was that they didn't introduce a multi-party system. There was no talk in Czechoslovakia of there being several parties. The Dubček claimed throughout the summer of 1968 that this was still a system under communist control. And the second thing being that the Hungarians took Hungary out of the Warsaw Pact. And it is believed that that was the one thing the Hungarian leadership did that brought in the Soviet tanks. And again, the Czechoslovaks were very careful to keep very careful party control over everything that was happening and not to leave the Warsaw Pact, not to question socialism. The idea was to reform socialism, to make it socialism with a human face. And this is why 1968 is a real rupture in East European history, that after this point, nobody had any illusions any longer over whether it was possible to reform Soviet-style socialism.
Questions?
And that is, like, 1968 was a pretty strange year all over the world, not just in Eastern Europe. And so there was a lot of unrest here. There was a lot of unrest in Western Europe. And so how do you kind of put that into the context? Because, in Western Europe and here, there was a lot of dissatisfaction and feelings of relative powerlessness against kind of the same kind of forces that were ruling analogously in Eastern Europe.
Well, I think that, in some senses, what was going on in the West was more of a cultural revolution. It was an attempt by one generation to assert its own influence, power, its ideas about life against the power of an older generation. The famous Mario Savio quote about trying to sort of put your body into the mechanism to stop it because it's become so inhuman, right? Well, in Eastern Europe, if you look at the ideas of the Prague Spring, I hate to say this because it's controversial, but really the most important reform communist, like Zdeněk Mlyna, she was actually a lawyer who knew Mikhail Gorbachev in the 1950s in Moscow. What they wanted to do was really reintroduce ideas from the 18th century of divisions of power and of responsible government and rule of law. In other words, in some senses, what the Prague Spring was a bourgeois revolution. It was a return, in some senses, to basic ideas that stood behind the revolutions of the 18th century. So on the one hand, of course, there was this 1968 that was international, Mexico City, Tokyo, Warsaw, Paris, right? Everywhere the young generation, in some sense, stood up and tried to assert its own ideas about how it should live and about the hypocrisies of the older system. But the core of the Prague Spring was really political, in my view. And I think that is different from what was going on in the West. It is often said that what happened in Paris in 1968 was actually over by about June of 1968, and that by late 1968 things had returned to normal, and that, in the U.S., if you went to the 10th anniversary of Woodstock, this famous New Yorker cartoon, everybody's wearing evening gowns and tuxedos. In other words, it was thought to be somehow insubstantial, whereas what the Prague Spring reformers were after was more substantial. It was the questioning of totalitarian power.
You had mentioned the Czech vote, the Czechoslovakian vote in 1946, in which the communists were the largest, have been the largest party to win. My question is it really fair to say that the Czechs and the Slovaks had voted for Stalinism in 1946? I mean, the vote could easily be interpreted as a vote against the parties that had not done anything about the Munich Agreement in 1938 in the earlier division of Czechoslovakia.
That's a really excellent question. I have actually read the press from that period very carefully, and including the communist newspapers and the social democratic newspapers of the period 1945 to 1948, which was a period of relative freedom in Czechoslovakia compared to the situation in Poland or Hungary or Romania or Bulgaria. Czechoslovakia was relatively free up until February of 1948. And if you read carefully the statements of leading communists like Václav Kopecký or Zapotocký, the trade union leader, or Klement Gottwald himself, these were not statements that differed, in my view, very substantially from those made by Soviet leaders. They were not about tolerance or about the value of freedom of speech or of rights. They were about destruction of the old order that was called bourgeois. They were about suppression of other people's rights, and that is precisely what happened after they seized power in 1948. They, for example, famously took one advocate of Czech women's rights, Milada Horáková. Before the Soviets forced them to do this, they put her on trial. This is, by the way, on YouTube. You can watch it. It's very difficult to watch. But this woman who was a prisoner of the Nazis was put on trial by the Czech communists and executed. She was put to death. This was something that was so outrageous in 1949 that Einstein and many others protested in vain. So my argument is that, in fact, you're right. I mean, obviously the people who voted in 1946 didn't necessarily desire what came. They didn't desire the bloodletting of the early 1950s. Certainly someone like Rudolf Slansky, did not desire that. But if you read carefully, you see that they were essentially voting for rights for themselves, the exclusion of rights of others, and immediately after the seizure of power in 1948, people who later became reform communists, like Jiří Pelikán, went after with a ferocity against their political enemies, and if not imprisoning them, made sure that they didn't have any access to any of the goods and the freedoms of society. So that would be my answer.
I would like to ask whether you can actually put the German occupation of Czechoslovakia in some context, what happened in 1946 and 48, that the German occupation was so terrible and people suffered so much that actually my parents told me that when Russians came, they were actually really welcome in Czechoslovakia because they looked like something so better than Germans. And I think that lots of the votes in those years probably did not really think about what you mentioned, but it was the pure reaction to the horrible occupation of Germans.
Maybe some of my colleagues have actually experienced
that. You're absolutely right that the first election 1946, it was sort of expression of support of the for the change against what was during the Nazis. The people believed that the old system under which German came over after 1938-39 is going to be changed, and the communist propaganda was quite skillful, very similar to the Nazi propaganda. But this next election, which was supposed to be 1948, before that election, because they knew that they are not going to win the election, they did the coup. The people realized what was happening, and they would lose the majority in the free vote. Therefore, what they did the coup.
And it's also important to state that in the eyes of millions of East Europeans, the Soviets did indeed come as liberators. They were the ones who opened up the concentration camps of that region. History is not as simple as we would like to think. It's not easy to divide in black and white categories, but it's clear that without the force of the Soviet Union, the liberation of that region would have come later. So it's a good point that you make.
Could you tell us something about the ups and downs of President Beneš?
Ups and downs?
Beneš?
You know, it's a very controversial issue. And I can tell you is my opinion, which is not necessarily shared by majority. So President Beneš, I think he was voted as a president after Masaryk died. It was a very, very close vote. People don't remember. It was one voice which gave him the presidency. He was, during the Masaryk era, he was the Minister of Foreign Affairs. He was considered quite successful. But in 1938, during the Munich time, he gave up, he quit. And he did the same thing in 1948, when the Communist Party coup, he quit. He basically agreed the Communist demands, allowed them sort of legally take over, and he simply quit presidency to allow the Communists to vote a new constitution. That's my view. I'm sure it's not shared by everybody. I think it's a controversial man. It did probably some good, but history is not very clear about his contributions. The judgment is out.
Yes. We have time for one very short question.
Yeah, I'll make one comment before Richard is going to close. Since this is about Prague, Spring 68, and its architect, Alexander Dubček, I'd like to tell you that Alexander Dubček died in 92, but in 89 and 90, he became the president of the federal parliament, something like Nancy Pelosi. And in 92, he died in a high-speed car crash when he traveled to Brno. Speculation still is that he was assassinated because assassination through poisoning or high-speed car crash is very popular among communists. Wait. No, this is not all. Alexander Dubček, 2 days from that day when he died, he was supposed to go to Moscow to be a witness in a trial against KGB. The same day when he died in a car crash, former Polish premier was assassinated in Poland in his house. He was supposed to be in the same trial, 2 days later.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Yes. It's yours. Our thanks to Robert Caron, John Connolly, Al Snod, Paul Goldsmith, and particularly Peter Polacek for your contributions to the club.
Thank you very much.
Yes. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, marking its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.